This is the download of Sport and the British from the BBC. You can find the terms and conditions on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Sport and the British is presented by Claire Balding.
Britain gave the Empire sport, and the Empire used it to strike back.
Sport and the British. The formal empire.
It's a grey, rainy day in central London. The taxis are whizzing by, but for those lucky enough to be members of a private gentleman's club, they can seek safe haven within the walls. And I am coming in to the East India Club. Thank you. At the height of the siege of Mafeking in April 1900, the commander of the besieging South African forces sent a note to the British forces defending the town. It didn't demand their surrender nor request negotiations. Instead, it politely asked if they would care to take part in a cricket match between the two armies. The British commandant brusquely rejected the suggestion. The East India Club is on St James's Square, just off Piccadilly, and as soon as you walk through the doors, you are struck by the combination of the old-fashioned English club, but with a certain exotic nature to it. The decoration on the ceilings is incredibly ornate, and actually going up the stairs are well over 200 shields, all of them from different public schools around the country. This club was formed by and for men who shared an interest in trade. They had a specific link to the East Indies, and they had a growing interest in and passion for sport. Now, through the 19th century, the global map had turned pink. A quarter of habitable countries were part of the British Empire, the largest empire the world had ever seen. If trade was the driving force behind the expansion of the empire, then sport was the glue that helped keep it together. Horse racing, boxing, athletics, polo, and even big game hunting helped to bind the colonists together and remind them of home. And no sport symbolised the Imperial British mission more than cricket.
Where a score or so of our sons are found, there is found cricket,
noted the novelist Anthony Trollope in 1868. As at home, cricket became much more than a game. It was a way of transmitting British values, a connection to the mother country, and a means to educate the empire's native subjects. So who were the imperial messengers that took sport with them across the seas and around the globe? Professor Richard Holt of De Montfort University.
The first cricket match in India was played in the early 18th century, by sailors working for the East India Company. The first matches in Australia, the West Indies, and South Africa, which took place between two teams of army officers, took place a century later in the early 19th century. Then, by the mid-19th century, virtually every British settler colony had its own network of cricket clubs. This was an attempt to recreate a British way of life far from home. Missionaries and school teachers, particularly eager disciples of Thomas Arnold, used the sport to teach traditional British values.
I've come into the library here at the East India Club, and it's wall-to-wall bookcases, above it dark green wallpaper with gold fleur-de-lis, and there's a lovely smell in here of the old books and the leather chairs, and you feel as if you could just sink back and pick up a volume of Wisden maybe to flick through. They're all here, and various other school histories and club histories, army and navy books, and lots of sports books. And it would have been members of a club like this who would have been the imperial messengers, taking sport with them across the seas and around the globe. So it was as part of the cultural bond between Britain and the colonies that the sporting tour appeared. England played Australia in Melbourne in 1877 in the first official test match between the two sides. Australia won by 45 runs. 5 years later, Australia played a series in England, and for the first time, the tourists beat the hosts on home soil. The Sporting Times was so devastated that it published a mock obituary for English cricket.
In affectionate remembrance of English cricket, which died at the Oval on 29th of August, 1882, deeply lamented by a large circle of sorrowing friends and acquaintances, R.I.P. N.B. The body will be cremated and the ashes taken to Australia.
It wasn't just cricket that attracted a passionate rivalry amongst Britain's colonies. I've come to the top floor of the East India Club, and here is a room entirely dedicated to the sport of rugby union, and in particular, the history of the Barbarians, a side that was formed in 1890 to tour the whole world, spreading the message of fast-flowing, exciting, fearless rugby. A rugby union with its overtones of muscular Christianity, its fame that was spread by Tom Brown's school days, and its fast-moving physicality was the running game of choice for white colonial settlers. In 1859, the Australian Tom Wills, who'd gone to school at Rugby, went to Melbourne, where he adapted a form of football based on what he'd learned at school, and that became Australian rules football. In New Zealand and South Africa, the game took hold. In contrast, football had a different pattern. That was mainly spread through commercial and industrial contacts rather than through conquest or settlement. Mickey Steele-Bodger is the chairman of the East India Club here.
I think in New Zealand it has made them a small country into a big country. I think they can stick their chests out, and I think they are a magnificent example of what really the empire has stood for. But I think that sport and rugby has contributed enormously. And I've toured there as an administrator 6 or 7 times. And the feeling and the love for the home countries is enormous. They still refer to it as home with a capital H. And I find that quite extraordinary.
Mickey Steele-Bodger has also been a selector for England and the Lions, the president of the Rugby Football Union, chairman of the International Rugby Board, and he's the current president of the Barbarians. He is steeped in the sport and has no doubt that the desire to play and beat the mother country has been a driving passion for the nations that were originally colonies.
Basically, I think that rugby, being what it is, a team game, has united the countries around the empire. Very much so. It was the first thing that really came over here to do. But from the very first tour in 1905, everything is set on playing and coming to England, and coming to Britain for that matter, but playing England is the one they want to beat. Like everything, nearly all the sports, we started them, didn't we? But we regularly get beaten in them now, which is fine because the new generation, the new people in emerging countries have got better at it than we have, whether because they work harder at it or they have more natural talent, nobody will know.
But sport wasn't merely a way of keeping the white colonists of the empire united. Clergymen, schoolmasters and later schoolmistresses, trained in the spirit of muscular Christianity, went out into the empire believing that sport was essential to imparting British values and morality to their colonial subjects. Alongside their Greek and Latin grammar, these evangelists carried with them a cricket bat and ball. Across the empire, schools were founded to teach colonial elites the British way of life. Based on the British public school model, these schools placed a heavy emphasis on sport.
We can see examples of the importance of the British public school model in the empire if we look at India. Rajkumar College is a classic example of the colonial elite school. Founded in 1868 to teach the sons of Indian princes, it was clear in its purpose, to quote, "We shall discipline their bodies in the manliness and hardihood of the English public schoolboy." Tom Brown's school days was read to the boys by the headmaster, and it produced two of India's greatest cricketers, Ranjit Singhji and Dulip Singhji, both of whom went on to play for England. At Mayo College, known as the Eton of India, the boys played cricket every day. In Africa, Akimota College in Ghana had 2 large cricket ovals, 4 football fields, 3 hockey pitches. It had better sports facilities than almost any school in Britain.
Professor Tony Collins, gradually sport began to be taken up across India, from the Maharajas through the middle classes, across all castes, even including the occasional untouchable. In fact, the star of Indian cricket in the Edwardian period was a left-arm spinner called Palwankar Baloo. He was a member of the Dalit, or untouchable caste. So not only was he battling racism from outside, he was battling it from within the Indian caste system. He became a hero for the many thousands of untouchables, a shining example of the triumph of meritocracy. Because on the pitch, it could be seen to be a level playing field. All men were equal, regardless of colour, class or caste. In Trinidad, the great West Indian cricket writer C.L.R. James used his experience of playing cricket at the elite Queen's Royal College to describe how black Trinidadians saw the cricket pitch as a level playing field, where the racial and social inequalities of imperial rule could be challenged through sport. It was this spirit that animated the golden age of West Indian cricket. I beg your pardon, what did you say? I said keep on say so. Say cricket, lovely cricket. Cricket lick the ball before it reached the wicket. Sport today is seen throughout the world as a hugely successful bonding mechanism. And the spirit of friendly imperial contest lives on in the modern Commonwealth Games. For local and national identity, sport can do what no product or government can. India, in particular, has a devoted cricket-following public. The Indian Premier League has injected big money into the game, and it attracts the top players from around the world. It's an important part of the image of the Tiger economy. Rajesh Prasad is the Deputy High Commissioner to the UK.
It is a kind of a passion which a lot of Indians have today. It's discussed in drawing rooms over dinners and dissected. I mean, there's a joke about it that when you have a cricket match, people in the offices are listening to commentaries or watching television if they're not on the ground. So there is something that it disrupts the normal functioning, and it does happen that way. I mean, people in the what we call the corner shops, the betel leaf, the pan shops, they have got transistors glued. People are cycling and listening to the scores. So it is a very big thing today, cricket. I feel it's in the blood of the Indians. They enjoy it.
One of the largest portraits here at the East India Club is of Queen Victoria, looking very stern, the matriarchal figure who bestrode the empire. Everything was done in her image. And although she herself had no interest in sport, she would have recognised its ability to unite the empire, to spread a British code of conduct. But sport had been adopted so thoroughly and so successfully that it was becoming a means by which colonial countries could assert their own character and independence. The tables were turning. India, Sri Lanka and Pakistan, South Africa, Australia and New Zealand had become world leaders in cricket, in rugby union and in rugby league. And by the 1960s, the empire had most defiantly and definitely struck back. And it was Britain that was lagging behind.
Thank you for downloading Sport and the British from the BBC.